Atzeri system, 10 standard years after the Yuuzhan-Vong War. Slave 1 in pursuit of prisoner Habuk. Boba Fett's private record.
Whatever he's paying you, Fett, I'll double it!
Says the voice on the comlink. They say that a lot. They just don't understand the nature of a contract. This time, it's an Atzeri glitterstim dealer called Habuk, who's overstepped the mark with the Traders Coalition to the tune of 400,000 credits. A contract's a contract, I tell him. Slave One is close enough on his tail to give me a visual on him. I swear he's flying an old Z95 headhunter. No hyperdrive, or he'd have jumped for it by now. And no wonder he's surprised. An old fire spray like Slave One shouldn't be able to catch him on sublight drive alone. But I've fitted a few more, extras recently. The only completely original part of Slave One now is the seat I'm in.
My laser cannon's armed!
Says her book, breathless.
Good for you. The galaxy's a dangerous place.
The headhunter executes a neat turn to port with its aft maneuvering jets, and Slave's laser locks onto the headhunter's drive signature, matching its turns and loops with no need for guidance from me. His engine flares in a ball of white light. The fighter begins an uncontrolled roll, and I have to gun it to get the tractor beam locked on and hull her book in. The grapple arms make a satisfying ka-chunk against the headhunter's airframe as I secure the fighter against the casing above Slave's torpedo launcher. Her book is making the noises of panic and pleading that I hardly notice these days. Some prisoners are defiant, but most give in to fear. He makes me offers all the way back to Atzeri, promising anything to survive.
I can pay you millions!
The contract is to deliver him alive. It's very specific.
And my stock holdings in Kuat Drive Yards!
I think it's the silent routine that gets to them in the end.
Fred, I have a beautiful daughter!
He shouldn't have said that. Now I'm angry. I don't often get angry.
Never use your kids, scumbag. Never.
Landing on Atzeri is a little tricky when you're hauling a crippled fighter on your upper works. I set Slave One down on the landing strip, lowering gently on the thrusters, feeling the aft section vibrating under the load. And I have an audience. The Coalition wants to show they can afford to hire the best to hunt down anyone who crosses them. I oblige. A bit of theater, a little public relations. Like Mandalorian armor, it makes the point without a shot needing to be fired. I walk along Slave One's casing to clamber up onto the headhunter's fuselage, and crack open its canopy seal with a laser housed in my wrist gauntlet. So I hit her book harder than I need to, and haul him out of the cockpit to rappel down 10 meters to the ground on the lanyard with him. It hurts deep in my stomach. I don't let anyone see that. Then I deposit the prisoner on the landing strip in front of the men he owes 400,000 credits. It makes the point. I like making points. Presentation is half the battle.
Want to keep the starfighter too?
Asked my customer.
Not my taste.
The spaceport utility loader comes to remove it from Slave One. I hold out my palm. I want the rest of my fee. He hands me the outstanding 250,000 creds on a verified chip.
Why do you still do this, Fett?
Because people still ask me.
It's a good question. I ponder it while I sit back in the cockpit and catch up with the financial headlines on the HoloNet news as Slave One heads for Kamino on autopilot. My doctor is meeting me there. He doesn't like the long journey, but I don't pay him to be happy. Now I find I'm thinking of a daughter, Aelin, who I haven't seen in 50 years, wondering if she's still alive. You see, I'm ill. I think I'm dying. If I am, then there are things I've got to do. One of them is to find out what happened to Aelin. Another is to decide who's going to be Mandalore when I'm gone. And the third, of course, is to cheat death. I've had a lot of practice at that.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Legacy of the Force, Bloodlines, by Karen Travis. read for you by Mark Thompson.
Chief of State's reception suite, Senate Building, Coruscant, 16 days after the raid on Centerpoint Station.
The worst thing about being 13 years old was that one moment you were expected to be an adult, and the next everyone treated you like a child again. Ben Skywalker, 13 and confused about what was expected of him, sat trying to be patient in the reception area of Chief Cal Omos's offices in the Senate building, taking his lead from his cousin Jason Solo. It was the kind of office designed to make you feel like you didn't matter. A whole apartment could have slipped into the space between the outer doors and the wall of Omos's personal office. Ben tried to occupy himself with the holozines stacked on the low grillwood table. The zines were all very dull and slightly outdated current affairs weeklies and political analyses, but one of them displayed an image of Jason. Ben picked it up and activated it, smiling at the next image of a rotating Centerpoint station, which didn't look quite so good in real life, since he had helped sabotage it. The holoreport featured clips of Corellian news of the raid on Centerpoint, but it didn't mention Ben, and he wasn't sure if that upset him or not. Some recognition would have been nice, but the Corellian sources that were quoted were pretty rude about Jason, calling him a traitor and a terrorist. The report wasn't very kind about Uncle Han either. A middle-aged man Ben didn't recognize was telling the reporter what he thought.
"So he calls himself a Corellian. But forget that blood stripe on his uniform pants. It might as well be a big yellow streak down his back. Because Han Solo is just a Galactic Alliance puppet. He's betrayed Corellia by sitting on his backside doing whatever his Alliance buddies tell him to. And his son's just the same."
Jason seemed embarrassed. Maybe he was more upset for his dad. Ben would have been. "You should use an earpiece to listen to those privately," said Jason.
"But you're famous."
Ben offered him the holozine.
"Wanna see?"
Jason raised one eyebrow and seemed more worried about his meeting with Chief Omos. "Fine, but I could do without Thrak and Sal Solo using me to humiliate my father in front of Corellia. You realize he gave all this information to the media, don't you?"
"Yeah, of course I do. But if we're not ashamed of it, why does it matter? We did the right thing for the Galactic Alliance. Centerpoint Station was a threat to everyone."
Jason turned his head very slowly with that half-smile that Ben had learned meant he was impressed. "But a lot of worlds are taking Corellia's side now. So do you think those stories do any harm or not?" Ben could always spot a test. He knew he had to say what he believed. There was no point trying to be too clever. He wanted to learn from Jason so badly that it burned him up.
"Some worlds will always go against the Alliance anyway. So we might as well let the people on our side know we're taking action. Makes them feel safer."
Jason nodded approvingly, and Ben felt a little force touch somewhere in his mind, as if Jason were patting him on the head.
"That's very perceptive. I think you're right."
Jason's smile faded for a moment, and he glanced toward the doors of Omos's office, looking as if he was willing the head of the Galactic Alliance to finish his meeting and come out. Ben began to pick up what had caught Jason's attention. There was a definite sense of conflict, of people arguing, and it was almost as clear as hearing it if you knew how to listen in the Force. Ben did now. Jason was a good teacher. Ben concentrated on Jason's face.
"What's happening?"
"Heavyweight politics," Jason said, barely audible. Eventually, the doors parted, and Admiral Nyathol strode out, radiating annoyance. Chief Omos appeared in the doorway behind her and forced a smile.
"Ah, Jason," he said. "I'm sorry to keep you. Won't you come in? And Ben, I'm glad you could make it too."
Nyathol glanced at Jason as if she didn't recognize him. He acknowledged her with a slight bow of his head. "Admiral," he said, smiling. "A pleasure to see you." Nyathol turned a little more to the side, the equivalent of a very frank stare for a Mon Calamari, a species with side-set eyes, and scrutinized both of them.
"You did a very fine job at Centerpoint Station, sir. And you, young man?"
Omos beckoned Jason forward. and Ben followed meekly. Omis did not make the tired comment that Ben had grown since he'd last seen him, nor did he look past him when he was talking to Jason. The chief met his eyes. It was both unsettling and exciting to be treated as an adult. Ben concentrated hard on what was being said. Omis sat behind his desk rather than in the chair opposite them, as if he were taking cover.
So, what brings you here, Jason?
I have a proposal.
Go ahead.
Crippling Centerpoint Station only bought us time with Corellia. We might have a few months at most before it's operational again, and then we're back where we began, but with a much more aggrieved Corellia that's gathering more support.
Go on,
said Omis. Now is the only time we'll have for preemptive action, before any real opposition to the Galactic Alliance has a chance to organize. Corellia, Commonore, and Chasen need complete dissuasion, very public dissuasion, to make a point to other governments about the need for unity and a complete neutralization of their capacity to fight a war, the destruction of their shipyards.
This, said Omis slowly, is not unlike another conversation I've just had.
The way he said conversation made it clear what he'd been arguing about with Niathal. So she wanted to take action, exactly as Jason did. We've slapped Corellia and made a martyr to a cause, said Jason. An armed martyr to an armed cause. If you give me command of a battle group, I can destroy the main shipyards and put an end to this now. If Corellia can be brought to heel, it sends the message that no single planet is bigger than the Alliance.
You're asking me to declare war, Jason, and that's something I'd never get Senate backing to do, and I know where the Jedi Council stands on this.
War's coming anyway. If you draw a weapon on a Corellian, you'd better be prepared to use it. We drew it when we took out Centerpoint. Omis was doing a good job of disguising his fear, but Ben could feel it. It didn't feel as if he was afraid of Jason. It was more a vague and formless dread, as if events were drowning him.
Talking of Corellians, would this attack not drive a huge wedge between you and your father?
It might well, said Jason. But I'm a Jedi, and it's precisely that kind of personal motivation we're trained to disregard.
I'll take it under advisement.
I'll take that as a no. Jason seemed perfectly calm. I can tell you with the certainty of the Force that failing to stamp out dissent completely now will result in the deaths of billions in the coming years. We stand on a tipping point where we can choose chaos or order. Omis meshed his fingers, hands on the desk, and stared at them.
I agree, we have a volatile situation here. But I think that escalating military action will be what tips us over into war, not what limits it. I remember the Empire, Jason. I lived through it, and I dread seeing us become that kind of government.
Jason just gave Omis a little nod and stood up to leave. Thank you for listening to my concerns. They took the long walk back to the Senate lobby, down a broad corridor lined with blue and honey-gold marble inlay, and traveled down to the ground floor in a turbolift with walls so highly polished they were almost an amber mirror.
Is politics always like that? Said Ben. Why don't you both say what you mean?
Jason laughed. Then it wouldn't be politics, would it?
And why does everyone keep saying, "Oh, I remember the Empire"? Uncle Han says it was bad, and so does Chief Omis. If they're both afraid of the same thing, why are they on opposite sides?
Jason seemed to find it very funny. Ben was embarrassed.
I was only asking, Jason.
I'm not laughing at you. It's just very refreshing to hear someone cut through the nonsense and ask real questions. They crossed through the forest of pillars of the Senate lobby and emerged into the hazy sunshine that bathed the plaza. Strung out in a ragged line, a group of around 200 people had gathered to protest in front of the Senate building. Dozens of Coruscant Security Force officers had formed a loose line in front of the building, but it looked peaceful. The occasional shout of,
"Corelli is not your colony!"
made it clear who the protesters were.
"Something tells me we'd better not stop and sign autographs," said Ben.
Jason stopped to look back at the protest. How many Corellians do you think live in Galactic City? 5 million? 5 billion?
Do you think they're dangerous?
I'm simply thinking what a complicated war this will be for Coruscant, because so many Corellians live here.
But we're not at war. Yet.
Not as far as governments are concerned, said Jason. But feel what's around you. Ben's force senses were a fraction of Jason's, trained in not much more than physical skills and the beginnings of true meditation. He closed his eyes. He felt the vague tingling at the back of his throat, the hint of something dangerous but far away. The slight breeze across the plaza swept scents of foliage with it. The protest continued, now a little noisier, but still peaceful.
I can feel a threat, but it's a long way away.
Ben opened his eyes, worried that he had answered the wrong question.
Like a really bad storm coming. Nothing more.
Exactly, said Jason. Billions of unsettled, unhappy people ready to fight. People who want things to be settled. People who need peace.
And that's our job, right?
Yes, said Jason. That's our job.
And I'll be working with you?
Yes, said Jason. Of course you will. It's not always going to be easy, but you can handle it. I know you can. Some of the things we'll talk about have to be kept between us, but that's the way with military matters. Are you ready for that?
Like Admiral Nyathol?
Jason smiled. Ben had guessed right again.
Yes,
like the Admiral, who I think is going to be an ally of ours.
I understand, Jason. I know this is serious.
Good. That's what I needed to hear. Ben basked in Jason's approval, but knew that wasn't the right thing to feel when they were talking about war. Right then, he wanted to know what had really happened to Brisha, the strange woman he hadn't much liked on first sight, and the Jedi called Nalani, who they had traveled with. Jason would say only that they had been killed. No details, no explanation. But Ben recalled none of it, even though he was certain that he had been somewhere with them. It was eating at him. He hated not remembering things that felt important, and this did feel serious and worth remembering.
Something's bothering you, said Jason as they walked away, leaving the Coruscanti protest behind them.
Yes, Ben thought, Brisha and Nalani. But Ben decided that part of growing up was knowing when to do as you were told, not like a child who didn't know any better, but as a soldier who understood that sometimes there were things you didn't need to know.
Nothing important, he said. Nothing at all.
Minister Kohane's office, cloning facility, Tipaka City, Kamino, 10 standard years after the Yuuzhan Vong War.
You're dying, said the physician.
Boba Fett could see the man's reflection in the wall-wide sheet of transperisteel as he stared out over the choppy seas. Tipaka City was a sad ruin of the minimalist elegance that it had been in his father's day, but its few crippled towers were still more of a haven for Fett than Coruscant would ever be. He concentrated hard on the dark surface of the sea and waited a few moments to see if the Iwas were gathering in pods again, then took in the doctor's words and digested them. They tasted familiar, inevitable, and yet were a ball of ice in his stomach. He resisted all movement in his facial muscles and presented a mask to the doctor that was as impenetrable as his Mandalorian helmet. Dr. Bellowine was one of only a handful who had ever seen him without it. Doctors could handle disfigurement a great deal better than most.
"Of course I'm dying," said Fett. "I'm paying you to tell me what I can do about it."
Bellowine paused and Fett watched him glance at Kohane, a Kaminoan scientist now in charge of a cloning facility that was a shadow of its former self.
"Nothing."
"How long?"
"You have a standard year or two, if you take it easy. Less if you don't."
"Don't guess. I deal in facts."
Bellowine's eyelids fluttered in a spasm of nervous blinking.
"There are always uncertainties in prognosis, sir. But the degeneration of your tissues is accelerating, even in your transplanted leg. You have recurring tumors, and the medication isn't controlling your liver function anymore. It might have something to do with the unusual nature of your background."
"I'm a clone, you mean?"
"Yes."
"I'll take that as a don't know."
"If I had access to the original Kaminoan laboratory records, then perhaps..."
"I need to talk to Kohane about that."
Show the doctor out.
The Kaminoan politician, all politely unfeeling gray grace, indicated the doors, and the doctor slipped between them before they had fully opened. He was very anxious to leave. The doors hissed shut behind him.
So where's the data? Said Fett. And Ton Hui?
Ton Hui has left.
When?
3 weeks ago.
Any reason for the timing?
Perhaps the galaxy's current political instability.
So she bolted in the end, just like Kosai.
I admit that some of my colleagues have shown a willingness to accept employment elsewhere.
Kaminoans weren't exactly keen on travel. Fett couldn't imagine anywhere they'd find tolerable beyond their own closed world.
And they took your data with them?
Koane seemed hesitant.
Yes. We have never located Kosai's original research.
So what's Ton Hui taken?
Apart from her human developmental expertise, a great deal of minor data.
The Kaminoans had lost their reputation as the top cloning technologists of the galaxy more than 50 years earlier, when their scientists defected. But nobody had ever equaled their quality since.
No point in hunting Ton Hui. Even the legs she cloned for me is degenerating. Spare parts won't help.
We have a use for that technology.
I don't.
Ton Hui may yet be useful to you. She is most skilled.
Maybe you should have hired me to hunt Kosai a few decades ago, rather than go after Ton Hui now.
We have reason to believe someone found Kosai. But we had sufficient expertise left to continue cloning without her, even if we had lost the original research on control of aging.
If anyone found it, they never tried to sell it. Who would sit on merchandise worth that much? Nobody I know.
It was probably Kosai's research that Fett needed now, but that was a trail that had gone very cold more than 50 years ago.
We both have reasons to recover as much data and as many personnel as we can. Will you help?
Making the most of me while I'm still alive?
Mutual benefit.
Benefit costs.
Fett turned away from the window and picked up his helmet.
I don't do help.
We can pay.
Okay. Dead or alive?
Alive, of course. $1 million to bring Ton Hui back alive, with the data.
$2 million to recover her, and an extra $1 million for the data. $3 million.
Excessive. I do believe your father was paid only $5 million for what amounted to creating and training an army.
That's inflation for you. Take it or leave it.
You need this technology as much as we do. $1 million.
I'll find it. And it's still $3 million if you want me to hand it back to you when I've taken the data that I need.
The most satisfying part of negotiation was knowing your walk-away point. He'd reached it now.
A professional's worth his fee, Koane. Take it or leave it. I'll find someone able to pay a lot more than you can, just to cover my expenses, of course.
But what use is your wealth to you now?
I've always got a use for it.
Koane was right. He didn't need any more credits, or any more power and influence either. Politics really didn't interest him. He'd served too many politicians, often in their machinations against each other. And he didn't even relish being the Mandalore, leader of the scattered Mandalorian community.
So why do I care at all?
He was the head of a ragbag of scattered Mandoade. There were farmers and metal workers and families scraping a living back on Mandalore. And there were any number of mercenaries, bounty hunters, and small communities in diaspora across the rest of the galaxy. It was hard to call them a nation. He wasn't even a head of state, not in the way Corellians or Coruscanti understood it. In the wake of the Yuuzhan Vong War, he had just 100 commandos to call on. But they were still doing what Mandalorians had done for generations, eking out a grim existence in the Mandalore sector, defending Mandalorian enclaves, or taking on the wars of others. He had no idea how many people who thought of themselves as Mandalorians were spread across the galaxy. 100 Mondo warriors was still a force to be reckoned with, though. And every Mandalorian was still a warrior at heart. Man and woman, boy and girl, They all still trained from childhood to fight.
I'm gonna be dead within 2 years. I'm 71. I should have another 30 in me, at least.
2 million credits to find Ton Hui and bring her back. That is my best offer.
I'm rebuilding your economy, Fett said. Don't insult me with small change.
You talk as if you have no emotional attachment to Ton Hui at all.
This is business, even if I am dying.
Take the bounty, and we will give you all our intelligence on her.
3 million.
Remember that even you cannot succeed alone.
They always say that,
said Fett. This was where he walked away for good.
When I find Ton Hui, I'll auction the data to cover my expenses. Start saving.
Fett expected Koane to run after him onto the landing platform, like stubborn customers always did when they saw sense. But when he glanced back behind him, the platform was empty. He slid into Slave One's cockpit and lowered the canopy. He'd spent a fortune restoring her for the third time, and adding modifications his father Django would never have dreamed of. Fett started up the drive and lifted Slave One into a standard escape trajectory. He needed to get on Ton Hui's trail. He checked his highly illegal and very reliable comm scanner and set it to watch for unusual share trading in bioengineering companies. Ton Hui had something to sell, and she would sell it, and the ripples would spread far enough for him to detect them sooner or later.
Air traffic control freight lane, Coronet Airspace, Corellia.
Han Solo would never get used to having to sneak into Corellian space like a criminal. It was one thing outrunning real enemies, but to crawl back to his homeworld in the Millennium Falcon under cover of a bogus transponder signal really rankled. He fumed silently and banked the Falcon a little more sharply than he planned.
You need to learn to meditate, said Leia.
I don't like the sound of the coolant systems.
She adjusted them manually without being asked.
Time for some maintenance, then.
Han's rough handling of the ship left Leia making silent but pointed safety adjustments that were as eloquent as a retort.
Before she blows a coolant line, or you burst a major blood vessel.
That obvious, huh?
And Jason's left 3 messages.
Han jerked the Falcon hard to starboard, a little too hard. The stabilizing drive groaned in complaint.
I'm not rational enough to talk to him right now.
Really? Never stop you before.
Sorry, sweetheart.
I'll keep talking to Luke, said Leia. But you talk to Jason, okay? I'm worried about him.
Will do.
Promise?
Would I argue with you, Princess?
Yes, you always do.
Han took the Falcon on a high approach path over Coronet, looking down the green patchwork of parks, public gardens, and farmland beyond that made it so very different from the Coruscant landscape. He set the ship down on the Civic landing strip, merging among a variety of vessels of all sizes and states of repair, and shut down the drives.
Okay, time to be ordinary, he said.
They split up to walk the distance to the apartment they had secretly rented a few days earlier. Just 2 middle-aged people who weren't together and who were merely faces in the city crowd. Han slipped into the lobby of the apartment building a little behind Leia and found her waiting at the turbo lift.
Now what's the first thing you're going to do when we get in?
She said.
Call Jason.
Good. You catch on fast. Don't shout at him, okay?
The lift doors opened onto the 56th floor and a dull beige carpeted hall with a few stained patches. Leia took 3 strides toward their apartment door and paused, left hand held out to her side to stop Han in his tracks. The fact that her other hand slid into her tunic and emerged holding her lightsaber prompted him into drawing his blaster.
Hear something?
He whispered, confused. They approached the apartment door with slow, careful steps.
Felt something, said Leia.
Threat?
No, but something isn't right.
They stood to either side of the door and looked at each other, sharing a thought. Who knows we're here? Leia ran her palm down the doorframe, not quite touching it, and shook her head.
Nobody inside.
Stand clear.
But somebody's been here.
Booby trap?
I can't sense any immediate danger,
Just a feeling that someone was very nervous when they came here.
Han touched the entry pad, blaster ready. Maybe they knew what a warm welcome we'd give uninvited visitors.
The door slid open, and they paused at the entrance, seeing only the apartment as they had left it days before, and hearing nothing except the faint sounds of the environment controls. Leia looked down and bent to pick up something from the carpet.
That's nice, she said, examining it, and then handed it to Han. Nothing like a happy family reunion.
It was a small sheet of flimsy.
Someone must have slipped it through the gap under the doors, and that took some doing.
A strange way to leave a message, but it was one that could never be traced electronically. Just a few words scrawled on a surface that was rippled as if someone had struggled to force it through the gap.
Han stared at it.
Sal Solo has put out a contract on you in reprisal for your son's actions at Centerpoint. Call me, Gedgen.
Leia raised an eyebrow.
Has your cousin threatened to kill you before? Formally, I mean. Random acts of violence don't count.
Thrakken hasn't got what it takes, Princess. He's all talk.
But Han's stomach still churned. It wasn't the prospect of assassination that worried him. He reckoned he could handle that. It was realizing that they were being watched by someone, and not knowing how and where.
And I don't know any Gedgen.
I once knew a man called Nov Gedgen, who was very active against the Human League. He loathed Sal Solo.
Leia referred to Thrakken as she would a total stranger. It was touchingly diplomatic.
But he'd be long dead now.
He had kids?
I don't know, but it's time I found out. Gedgen didn't bother to include his contact details, so he thinks one of us will know where to find him.
Thrakken would send Fett. Han just knew it.
Coruscant, the Skywalker's apartment.
The shrouded man wouldn't leave Luke alone now. The image of the man, cloaked, hooded, anonymous, intent on evil, intruded on his dreams more frequently. Not in the way of normal nightmares, but as a clear vision in the Force. And that was worse than any nightmare. It had the potential to be real, if it wasn't already. He couldn't see the man's face. In his dream, he was chasing him, trying to grab that hood from his face. But he always woke up at the point where he felt his fingers close on the fabric. It felt like lightweight bantha wool. His fingers clutched again. Both the robe and the man dissolved, and Luke woke, heart pounding, fighting a feeling of overwhelming despair and anger at himself for not seeing what was close enough to touch. He decided he wasn't going to get back to sleep, and got up as quietly as he could to avoid waking Mara. With the light that spilled from Galactic City's 24-hour activity and his own force sense, he didn't need to switch on the lights to pour himself a glass of water. Luke drank while he watched the constant movement of lights from the window. He felt Mara walk up behind him and give him a soothing touch from the doorway, just a brief, warm reassurance at the back of his mind.
You could have made us both a cup of caff, she said. If we're going to give up sleeping, might as well do it right.
You'd think I'd take times like this in my stride by now. Mara tidied her hair with one hand as she fumbled with the caff dispenser.
Politics? I don't think that ever gets easier. Not when your own family is tied up in it.
It's Ben I'm most worried about.
He gave a good account of himself at Centerpoint.
But he's 13. Okay, I let him go, but he's still a child. Our child.
How old were you when you dived headlong into the rebellion? Not that much older.
I was 18.
Whoa, veteran, huh?
She winked.
Sweetheart, Jason is taking care of him. He couldn't have a better teacher.
Yeah.
Okay, I know we aren't going to agree on that.
You know how I feel. Jason makes me uneasy. Jason plays fast and loose with his own powers. He's projected himself into the future, and don't tell me that didn't worry you. I don't want Ben learning that kind of thing. And do we really know what skills Jason learned while he was away? He's changed, Mara. I feel it.
She pressed a cup into his hand and stroked his hair. But all he could feel now was a distance that shouldn't have been there, as if she was becoming wary of him, or wary of upsetting him. Jason's grown up too.
He's taking a different path as a Jedi, that's all. We don't have all the answers.
It's more than that, Mara. I'm having dreams, and they're about a threat to us.
You really believe Ben's at risk?
I feel Jason is at risk. I don't want Ben sucked into this with him.
The future isn't fixed.
Oh, but it is when Jason tampers with it.
Whoa, let's not fight about this.
I want us to find another mentor for Ben.
Fine.
He felt her shoulders tense.
Go ahead and alienate Ben just when he's starting to settle down. So what if Jason's explored some strange philosophies and communed with bugs? We've both been into the dark side, and we came through it.
So you can feel the dark side?
No, I feel that Jason's developing powers way beyond mine, and that he's good for Ben, and that he would never harm him.
She stepped back from Luke, and he sensed she was shutting him out now, perhaps to stop the conversation from degenerating into an argument that would have no winners.
That makes him a good influence. Without Jason, we'd have a teenage son with strong force powers who won't listen to us. Now that's really dangerous.
She had a point. It seemed a good moment to concede. I can't argue with that.
But?
I never said but.
I heard but, and I felt but.
But I'd be neglecting my duty if I didn't put some effort into finding out who or what this is in my dreams. Of all the dreaded things that came to Luke in those dreams and visions, the one that plagued him most was the feeling of familiarity. He had felt something like this before. He just couldn't pin it down.
Jason Solo's private apartment, Coruscant.
I wish you were here.
Jason could reach out and touch Tenil Ka in the Force. And at that moment, he would have given nearly anything to see her and his daughter, Alana, again. He closed his eyes and saw Tenil Ka, the same smile as when he had first left her, cradling the baby, and let his presence expand and merge gently with hers. He felt the warmth spread up from his stomach into his chest. She had felt him and returned the touch.
Baby? Alana was 4 now. She was a little girl. Walking and talking.
Every time he sneaked a visit to see her, she'd grown a lot. He let the warmth fade before it became a lasting beacon for... he wasn't sure yet. But Tenil Ka would understand that he had to be discreet even in the Force these days. He drew his touch back to the here and now. It felt like a final goodbye. Jason wasn't sure how much Lumaya could detect, and his secret family had to be protected. But the person he most wanted to have at his side then was his grandfather, Anakin Skywalker. A man he had never known, but who had stood where Jason stood now, on the threshold of becoming Sith. Once crossed, there was no return. It wasn't one of his explorations of eyeing tea, flow walking, or some other arcane force skill that he could dabble in and withdraw from when it suited him. It was everything he had been raised to reject. And yet what Lumaya had shown him was so true, so inevitable, and so necessary that he had no choice but to believe it.
But can I believe Lumaya?
Her skills were prodigious. He'd been taken aback by the Force illusion in her asteroid habitat. Lumaya might well have been a true Sith follower, fighting to prove to Jason that history was a one-sided story written by the Jedi. Or she might have been a clever, manipulative, and infinitely patient woman with her own agenda, seeing Jason as a useful stepping stone along the way. Ben was still asleep in the suite next door. The boy had done a lot of growing up in the last few weeks, and Jason saw the man he would become, strong, but measured, and able to control his passions. But today's work was for Jason alone. He summoned an air taxi and headed for the Senate building. The taxi dropped him in the plaza, where a few people were already entering and leaving the huge dome structure. Senate delegates kept odd hours. There was always activity in the building, always a debate or a select committee or some business in progress 24 hours a day. The Mon Calamari started their day early, and Jason wanted to simply run into Nyathol without arranging a meeting and so attracting attention. And he could do that. He simply found the offices where she and other Mon Calamari had gathered, settled on a padded bench in the lobby, and watched the doors. He thought of Lumaya while he waited. And Ben had asked if he was going to tell Luke about Brisha and Nalani.
"Hello, Uncle. Lumaya's back. Thought you'd like to know. For old time's sake."
No. It wasn't news he felt he could break to him. He heard doors part and the muffled sounds of voices. Admiral Nyathol appeared in the lobby in a white uniform, very formal, and had no choice but to spot him.
"Jedi Solo,"
she said, giving him that sideways stare.
"Are you here on business?"
"Just passing."
"I'd like to hear your account of the raid on Centerpoint. It would be very helpful."
Jason bowed his head politely. "Would you like to continue the discussion outside this building?" Nyathol began walking toward the exit without answering. They didn't speak until they were outside and crossing the plaza. Nyathol was not one for small talk, and Jason liked her forthright manner.
"How far back have we really set Centerpoint Station?"
she asked. They headed for the public landing area and got into one of the waiting air taxis.
"Kyan Club, driver."
That was a very exclusive officer's club that Jason had never visited. Useful. He closed the partition that separated the passenger cabin from the cockpit to ensure privacy. 6 months, he said. No more.
"Then, that's how long we have until a full war breaks out."
She left the Stark analysis hanging on the air, as if she was waiting for Jason to fill in the silence. "I don't feel the galaxy can take another war so soon after the Yuuzhan Vong invasion," he said.
"It'll be the fourth major war in a century. Yes, poor odds."
"I'd like to be able to look forward to a century without war."
"And I'd like to be forced to look for another job, Jedi Solo."
Jason thought for a moment that she was being brutally open about her political ambitions, but the way she rolled her head slightly and looked at the battle honor ribbons on her uniform made him realize she meant an end to any need for war. Perhaps the two were the same thing. "My own family is divided over this."
"Most Jedi never have families,"
Nyathol said. "We've had an interesting relationship with what we call attachment." Was she checking out his loyalties? "My duty as a Jedi is to consider trillions of other lives."
"If we continue to botch actions like the Corellian engagement, then we could be in for a long war."
"I've thought about how successful an attack on their shipyards might be," Jason said.
"I doubt the political will could be bent to more than support for a blockade."
"Ties up a lot of resources."
"So do assaults on multiple fronts."
The taxi headed south from the Senate, through a city of people beginning the day and others returning after a night at work. They were in the heart of the restaurant district that served the Senate, its skylanes lined with smart places to eat and elegant hotels and private clubs where politicians and senior military officers could find rooms and discreet service.
"I prefer my club to having a home here," said Nyathol,
as if Jason looked curious. He was just feeling distracted by something that began nagging at the back of his mind.
"Now perhaps we can give further thought to this blockade. So..."
Jason jerked his head around, suddenly seized by such a powerful sense of immediate danger that his instinct was to fling himself on Nyathol and wrap the taxi tight in a force shield. The vessel bucked hard, as if it had been hit by a tidal wave. There was a second of silence before a deafening whoop shook it like a box, and they were caught in an instant blizzard of what seemed to be glittering snow. It hammered the hull as Jason fought to hold the taxi steady, oblivious of the pilot's efforts. Shattered transparasteel. It seemed to go on for minutes. The pilot was shouting. Jason straightened up, staring into the rapidly blinking eye of a shaken Nyathol, and knew they had caught the tail end of a huge explosion.
"Oh, just look at that," said the pilot.
He seemed to be holding the taxi stationary now without Jason's unseen assistance. Nyathol swallowed hard.
"Well, this changes everything."
Jason could feel what had happened, but it was still a shocking sight. Ahead of them, the skylane seemed to be a gaping hole of nothing, as if a whole mass of speeders had fallen out of the sky, which they clearly had. And for 100 meters, the buildings on either side were like jagged open mouths. Each transparent steel frontage had been blown out. The force was torn with anger and fear and shock.
"Corellians," said the pilot.
His voice was shaky. He reached an instant conclusion that didn't even allow for the possibility of an accidental explosion. So would many other Coruscanti. Like Niathal, his first thought was that a bomb had been detonated and that the skirmishing had escalated into something that would harden everyone's stance. Terrorism had returned to Coruscant. "Maybe not," Jason said. "And maybe in the end it really doesn't matter who." The driver looked at Jason as if he were insane.
"Driver, take us back to the Senate building any way you can," said Niathal. "Jedi Solo, I need to talk to our senator."
"This is going to get ugly very fast," Jason said.
"Going to take some strong, reassuring action then," said Niathal.
Jason's mind raced ahead. This was perfect timing for Lumaya's purposes, unnaturally so. The fact that he couldn't feel her hand in this meant nothing. She seemed to be capable of deceiving him. But that almost didn't matter. Events had been unleashed that would have a life of their own. He was needed more than ever. He could avert total anarchy. And that was a dangerous thought. But he thought it anyway. Somebody had to. And somehow, he needed to test Lumaya.
The Skywalker's apartment, Coruscant, 0800 hours.
Mara almost dropped her cup and steadied one hand on the table. "What's wrong?" Luke caught her shoulder and leaned over her. "Honey, are you okay?"
"Jason,"
she said. Luke sought Ben in the Force immediately. He was there, with no hint of concern or danger. Jason, though, was not. There was nothing of him to detect.
"He just blinked out," said Mara. "I know he can do that when he wants to, but this felt weird."
She paused, eyes fixed in defocus at the far side of the room. Mara stood up and pushed her hair back behind her ears, still looking distracted.
"Holonet," she mumbled, and switched on the screen, looking for a news channel. "I get the proverbial bad feeling about this. I just need to know what's going on."
She was right. Luke began to sense a welling anxiety and disturbance, a sense of something growing like a bank of storm clouds. The HNE newsflash announced that there had been an explosion in the hotel district south of the Senate. There was, said the holoanchor, speculation that it was a bomb. "If that was a terrorist bomb," said Luke, "then we'd better head over to the Senate, because Omis is going to want to discuss the implications." Mara grabbed a jacket, not one of her usual fashionable ones, but something gray and functional, as if preparing for combat.
"I hope nobody jumps to conclusions too fast. It's one of those things that could tip people here into doing something rash."
Luke gestured toward the landing platform. "I'll drive. You monitor the news." HNE kept using the word explosion and managed to make it sound like bomb every time. Luke tried to slip the airspeeder through the increasingly congested sky lanes as traffic backed up from the scene of the explosion. He glanced at Mara.
"What if it's not a bomb? People jump to conclusions. If they want to believe it's a bomb, facts won't get in the way."
"I can't imagine Corellia resorting to planting bombs in civilian areas."
"Corellia," Mara said. "See? We all do it. I thought of Corellia too. We've got 1,000 species on Coruscant, and most of them have their dingbat element. It could be anybody."
"Perception usually overrides facts."
"You said it, sweetheart."
The speeder had slowed to a crawl in the traffic as sky lanes above and below them backed up. Luke found the next public landing area and set the speeder down to continue the journey on foot. As Luke and Mara walked toward the Senate, the public holonews display screens were surrounded by people staring up at the unfolding news, grim-faced. The display showed which parts of Galactic City had now been sealed off, and harassed fire service officers explaining that they still hadn't reached the scene of the blast or assessed the total number of casualties. Luke took Mara's arm and pressed on through the crowds. It took them half an hour to reach the Senate, and Omis had already left the chamber to visit the Emergency Response Command Center deep below ground level. They walked into a huge room that appeared to be one large holodisplay packed with uniformed officers. The sign above the door simply said Strategic Center. This was where Joint Galactic City authorities managed the longer-term effects of an incident, planning for what was needed in the days that followed. While the minute-to-minute work went on at the tactical and operational command centers down the chain. When Luke concentrated on what he had walked into, he realized that every branch of the city's emergency services had personnel there. He recognized Coruscant Security Force, Fire and Rescue, Air Traffic Control, Med Center Managers, and the City Authority. Omis stood talking to a young CSF captain in front of a data display. When Luke walked up behind them, he saw they were looking at a changing list of casualties. Omis turned to Luke and Mara and shook his head.
"We can rule out an accidental explosion," he said. "CSF picked up traces of commercial-grade detonite."
"Where was it placed?" Luke asked.
"In one of the hotels," said the CSF officer.
The ID tab on his tunic said Shivu.
"The Elite. There's no obvious motive for the location, but it looks as if it detonated in a guest room. Might have been an own goal."
"Own goal?"
"Blew up while the terrorist was handling it."
"So we have a room to go on. Then we ought to have an identity for the guest."
"We're checking that out."
"We can't afford to guess at this." Captain Shivu looked down his nose at Luke, polite but clearly irritated by the suggestion.
"I don't guess about anything, sir. We're working with hard information that's coming in from tactical and operational. And where there are gaps, they stay as gaps until we have data."
"And what will our response be if this turns out to be Corellians?" Omis seemed to take exceptional interest in a status board showing the list of premises affected by the explosion, with red points of light indicating whether they had been checked and secured yet.
"If this isn't shown beyond doubt to be the responsibility of the Corellian government, then our response must be to treat it as any other crime."
"I think Master Skywalker means the less formal response," said a voice behind Luke. He hadn't even felt Jason enter the room. The fact that Jason could startle him was disturbing. Mara turned too, and even though Jason was standing there in front of them, Luke couldn't feel him. And judging by her expression and her little flare of anxiety in the Force, Mara couldn't either. Then, like scent suddenly wafting up from a blossom, Jason's presence was there, all around them, magnified. "So he wants to show me how powerful he is." Luke regretted the hostility in his thoughts, but it did nothing to reassure him.
"Sorry, Uncle," said Jason.
The tension was, of course, invisible to a room full of non-Jedi.
"I got caught up in the blast. I came to see what I could do."
Upper City, Taurus.
Boba Fett didn't care if anyone recognized Slave One as his ship. There wasn't much they could do about it. Stealth was fine in its place, but he didn't have to hide. And the restored shell of once glorious Taurus was so far off the beaten track these days that there really was a chance that nobody here knew who he was. It was a useful base for the time being. He set the defense shield on Slave One and walked along the promenade, drawing cautious glances from some of the smartly dressed residents out for their evening stroll. Goron Bavin was waiting for him at the plush Horizon Hotel. He sat at the bar with a large mug of Teresian ale and a bowl of something that might have been deep-fried crustaceans of some kind. He'd almost deferred to the bar's dress code. His helmet was placed on the bar beside him. But in his deep blue battle-scarred Mandalorian armor, he still didn't fit in among the beautifully dressed patrons. Fett walked up behind him.
"You always sit with your back to the doors?"
Bavin turned, apparently not startled to hear the voice of his Mandalore, ruler of the clans, commander of super commandos. Fett had never quite come to terms with his peacetime role.
"When I've assessed the risk, yes."
He looked at Fett's helmet with slow deliberation.
"Can I get you an ale and a drinking straw?"
"You're right. What are those?"
Bavin popped one of the fried things in his mouth and crunched with exaggerated relish.
"Corn crabs. Reminds me of those happy days we spent frying Yuuzhan Vong."
"Sentimentalist,"
Fett said, as he sat down on the stool next to Bavin, adjusting his holster carefully. The bartender, a middle-aged human male whose high-collared uniform looked as expensive as his customer's evening dress, had a question forming on nervous lips. Fett knew it was probably a reminder that Sir should remove his helmet. He turned his head so that it was clear he was staring at the man through his visor and waited for him to change his mind. He did. Fett turned back to Bavine.
Get on with it.
Thrakken Sal Solo approached me with a contract on the whole Solo family.
Wonder why he didn't ask me to go after Solo,
said Fett.
Everyone else did.
Maybe he thinks you'd be bored with it, and too expensive.
Right on both counts.
Han Solo was irrelevant now. Truly irrelevant. Fett had never had a feud with him anyway. Just a string of contracts, and contracts were never personal.
So?
So I hear he's had a few takers.
Not you.
I don't do families. I only hunt criminals. I don't want to be one.
I'm still waiting.
Okay. Word is that Aelin's back, and interested in the contract, too.
Fett was glad of the privacy of his helmet. He rarely registered surprise, because there was almost nothing left in the galaxy that could surprise him. But this felt suddenly raw, even after decades. His only child was alive. He'd heard nothing of her since the Yuuzhan Vong invasion, when billions had lost their lives. How old would she be now? 54? 55?
Somehow I knew she wasn't dead.
It beats her taking a contract on me.
His stomach chilled.
No, you don't mean that at all. You mean that she's your daughter. However much she hates you, however much she blames you for her mother's death, and you're dying, and you want to see her one last time. She's all you'll leave behind to prove that you ever existed.
Who else knows?
I thought nobody did, because she's calling herself Aelin Haber.
Fett waited. Bavine took a pull of his ale and said nothing.
So what makes you think she's Aelin Vel?
My sources tell me she's about 50 and has a Kiffar facial tattoo and flies a KDY assault ship that I think you'd recognize.
His daughter had hated him enough to kill him and take his ship and armor. At least, that's what she thought had happened. Had she ever found out she'd killed a clone instead? Fett had managed to shrug off the news at the time. It was more than 20 years ago, but it felt different now. He wanted to know where she had been, what she had done, but it was stupid and irrelevant and far too late. He put the impulse aside.
I hope she's careful then,
he said.
Ver Orisha Beskargem.
Bavine took a pull at his ale.
A warrior is more than one's armor.
Fett rounded on him.
What?
Aelin, wearing your armor, flying your ship. No substitute for a fighting spirit. You still don't speak Mandoar, do you?
Basic and at ease. That's what I do business in.
Maybe we need a little less business and a little more Mandalore, Bobika.
Bobika. Some of his father's associates had called him that as a kid. His father never had, but he ignored the over-familiar form of his name.
I'm busy right now.
Nothing else you want done?
No.
I better be going. Just call if you have orders for me.
Bavine drained the last of his ale and scooped the uneaten coin crabs into a napkin to fold them up and pocket them.
You're my Mandalore, after all.
Bavine replaced his helmet and walked out without a backward glance. Without a drink in front of him, Fett had no reason to sit there any longer either. He slid off the stool, to the visible relief of the bar staff, and wandered back to Slave One, taking in the sights along the way. There was a share dealing shop on the walkway. Fett paused and walked into the vividly lit lobby to stand in the constantly shifting interactive holodisplay of the various markets. Coruscant's CSX, its domestic stock index, had taken a sudden dip since he'd last checked the markets on his inbound journey. The little red line was still edging down against the top million ISE index. Fett stretched out a gloved finger and touched the index that read biotech. A cascade of sub-indices tumbled out on a table, and he ignored select company to choose volume share movement. That brought up the ranked list of companies where most shares had been traded over any given period. He chose one standard month, Three companies top the list: Santec, Arumed, and Arcanian Micro. Arumed's share prices hadn't shifted more than 10%, though, and they were always among the top price shares. It was Arcanian Micro that caught his eye. The green icon beside the name told him it was small and relatively new, but someone had bought a 25% block of its dirt-cheap shares in the last week.
Let's see what looks so appealing to them, then.
The database located Arcanian Micro's headquarters on Vohai. Fett made his way to the sparsely furnished apartment he'd bought a year before and that would not, for once in his life, become an asset that made a quick profit. Taurus wasn't a fast-moving property market, but it was worth paying for the relative privacy. His helmet sensors told him a human was walking behind him, maintaining a constant distance. It was a young woman, 18 maybe, with dark curly hair cut close to her head. He could see the image in the heads-up display of his helmet, relayed from the rangefinder's rear view. And while she had a blaster holstered on one hip, who didn't go around armed these days, she looked neither local nor hostile. She was wearing gray body armor, basic chest and back plates, like a Mandalorian, but without colors or markings.
But she's following me. I know it.
Behind him, the girl quickened her pace and caught up with him, close enough now to reach out, take two quick steps, and touch him. He turned before she could do it, and stood blocking her path, irritated. She didn't seem startled. She stared into his visor, much as Baveen had, which was unusual in itself.
"You're Boba Fett?"
she said.
"You passed your eyesight test."
"I need to talk to you."
"Whatever it is, you can't afford me."
"But can you afford me?"
Fett thought for a moment that he'd really read her completely wrong. But she held out her clenched fist, palm up, and parted her fingers to reveal a flat disc of opalescent stone, gold shot with red, blue, and violet. A leather strip was threaded through a hole drilled on one edge. It was a Heart of Fire gemstone. He knew because he had given one like it to Cintas Vell when they were married. It was from her home, from Khifu. He'd been just 16, Cintas not much older. No, he had given this very stone to her. This was the same gem. He could see the carved edge, like rope.
"Four lines of a Mandalorian marriage vow that we didn't understand. A stone that she said had some part of my spirit in hers, held in it forever."
Forever amounted to 3 years. They'd split up before Aelin was two. Cintas had gone bounty hunting when Aelin was 16 and never returned.
"That's why my own daughter was ready to kill me." "Where did you get this?"
he asked as calmly as he could.
"From the man who killed your wife," she said. "Your daughter owes me a bounty, and I know exactly where she is."
Cards Tapcalf, Blue Sky Boulevard, Coronet.
It was how you behaved that made the difference, Han decided. He sat in the Tapcalf, facing the window, and watched for Leia through the rain-streaked transparisteel. He thought he'd be recognized at last, but once he'd got used to not striding purposefully and drawing attention to himself, and started to move like a regular person, matching everyone else's pace, shoulders relaxed, nobody seemed to notice him. There was a holoscreen on the wall behind him, and NewsNet was running. Normally it washed over him as part of background noise, but even over the hiss of steam from the calf machine at the bar, he heard very clearly the words bomb and Corellian. So did everyone else in the tap calf. Silence fell. The staff even shut down the hissing calf pressure filter, and everyone turned in their seats or on their stools to watch the bulletin. The scenes from Coruscant were terrible. One hovercam shot tracked down from a shattered hotel frontage to where the remnants of a sign, just the letters ELI, hung from a dangling section of permacrete clinging to the tower by a thin strand of Durasteel reinforcing wire. The cam dropped level after level to the bottom of the urban canyon, showing less damage as it descended, but then settling on a shocking image of what had fallen finally to the ground level. Speeders, masonry, and bodies. Han, a man used to war, looked away and shut his eyes. Someone put a hand on his arm. Han. It was a man, and Han's instinct was to jerk his arm back and draw a blaster. but he stopped dead, hand a split second from his holster. The man was about 25, dark skin, black hair, cut almost military short, a stranger.
Do you know me?
Han was ready to drop him where he stood.
Because I don't know you, pal.
But your wife knew my father.
Prove it.
Han saw familiar movement outside the window, and Leia, the hood of her tunic pulled up against light rain.
How did you find us?
Gedgen, if that's who he was, dropped his voice almost to a whisper.
When you rented the apartment, you paid in untrackable credits. That's a lot of hard currency. Unusual enough to draw attention right now.
From who?
From our own security forces.
So Corsec knows we're here and Thraken doesn't?
Han nearly spat out the name.
Right. Try again.
You're assuming that everyone in Corsec would want to tell Thraken.
Han shook his head slowly.
Why do I get the feeling that I don't want to know that?
Well, there's Corellia, and there's Thraken, and they're not the same thing in many people's eyes. People who'd like to do something about it.
Call me cynical, but I think you're talking about a change of administration without an election. I'm trying to remember the word for that.
Gedgen, he could be nobody else, sat down next to him. As Leia came into the tapcaf, she stared at Han, and then at Gedgen, and her lips parted as if she had realized something that quite pleased her.
You're the image of your father,
she said.
Der Gedgen, said the young man very quietly.
He held out his hand for shaking, and their voices were lost in the chatter that swamped the tapcaf again.
At your service, ma'am.
Hi, Ernie, said Han. This nice young man is about to ask me to take part in a coup.
He smiled theatrically at Gedgen.
Did I get the right word?
I asked him to meet us here,
Leia said quietly.
But he's early.
Apologies, it's a habit, just in case messages are ever intercepted. Shall we move on? Gedgen indicated the door.
You can choose the location, just to reassure you in case you think I'm setting you up.
Good idea, said Leia.
I know just the place.
She beckoned to Han. He rolled his eyes, but gulped down the remains of his calf and followed her out into the rain, staying to one side of Gedgen so he could keep an eye on him. Leia led them to a woman's fashion store.
There goes my tough guy image, said Han,
hesitating at the ornately gilded doors.
Turbolift, said Leia, gesturing both men inside with an expression of narrow-eyed mock impatience.
Under the circumstances, she seemed in a good mood.
There's a calf bar on the top floor, nice and public with several exits if anything happens that we're not expecting.
They huddled around a table, surrounded by chattering shoppers and noisy children, and tried to look unremarkable. The ubiquitous hollow screen murmured away on one wall. Corellians were addicted to news.
Okay, where were we?
Said Han.
I remember. Removing the elected government. Go ahead and amaze me, kid.
He offered Gedgen a small jug.
Cream? Sugar?
Han, Leia fixed him with a stare.
Sorry, honey.
He leaned back and folded his arms.
Go on, Gedgen.
The young man was still totally unperturbed.
You're at risk, and so is Corellia. From the same source.
Power-crazed galactic government?
Power-crazed individuals.
That's half the galaxy on a good day.
Sir, your cousin isn't doing anybody any favors.
I didn't choose my family.
Well, he's going to kill yours, because he's put out a contract on you, your wife, and your children. And if he carries on the way he's going, he's also going to get a lot of Corellians killed in a war we can't win.
Han still didn't know what use they were to Gedgen, but he took an instant dislike to phrases like can't win.
So you want us to do something?
See, I have this hunch that you do.
If Thraken is removed, would you consider taking his place?
Oh boy. No.
Even Leia looked taken aback.
Absolutely not, she said.
Yeah, I already said that, honey.
Gedgen managed a nervous smile.
I didn't mean to embarrass you, sir.
I'll do anything for Corellia, said Han. And I agree that Thraken's conducting his own war for his own ends, like he always does. But there's a real threat out there from the Alliance, and it's going to take a united Corellia to stand up to it. Just give me a blaster, not an office.
You're not going back to Coruscant, then?
Why should I? We're not running from Thraken.
Han slipped his hand under the table and caught Leia's hand. She gave it a squeeze that threatened to numb his fingers.
And we're not going to live in hiding on Coruscant either. Might as well be here.
I understand.
Fine.
The good news is that Thrakken seems to think you're on Coruscant.
Well, that's another good reason for staying put, isn't it?
When we find out who's taken the contract, we'll warn you. Gedgen stood up and shook their hands. He had a mature, solid air about him, an elder statesman in a young man's body. If you'd like help to relocate, you know where to find me. If we could track you, so might others.
I think I already know who'll find me.
Han watched Gedgen leave. When he was sure the man had disappeared into the turbolift, he turned to Leia.
Well, you didn't say much for a hotshot diplomat.
It's not appropriate for a Jedi to discuss political coups.
Yeah, I can understand how that might be a sensitive area. How did you trace him?
I looked up Gedgen in the comlink directories.
Han laughed out loud. A large woman in a bright orange suit that really didn't do her any favors turned to look at him for a second. Funny, we always think this is cloak and dagger stuff.
Gedgen doesn't need to hide. He's an elected representative of a legal political party, the Democratic Alliance. They have a lot of seats in the Corellian Assembly now. With the Corellian Liberal Front, they actually formed the largest of votes. But Thrakken's still hanging on.
If that dirtbag comes anywhere near you or the kids, I'll kill him, I swear.
You think he's got a chance of taking on 3 Jedi?
He won't. Contra.
You think it's going to be Fett, don't you?
Yeah.
No, not Fett. Why would he? He saved us from the Vong.
Because business is business, maybe.
Han could feel something rising in his chest, and it wasn't the effect of way too much calf. It was something animal and irrational, something that was making his pulse pound in his temples. It was anger and fear. Not for himself, though, but for Leia, Jaina, and Jason.
Thrakken's done some dirty things, but he never went this far before. Not hiring hitmen. That changes everything.
He had a thought, and it was the one that almost made him recoil.
I'm gonna kill the scumbag this time. Nobody touches my family.
Lost in his thoughts, Han stirred the remains of his calf with a spoon, wondering how they got the foam to last that long, and then was jerked out of his trance by the one thing guaranteed to get anyone's attention, his own name. The words Han Solo cut through the hubbub of voices and children squealing as if the tap calf had fallen into total and complete silence for a moment.
In a statement issued by the Office of the State, President Sal Solo has declared Han Solo and his family to be enemies of Corellia following the attacks on Centerpoint and Rilladeer, and he's ordered their arrest,
said the HNE hollow anchor. Han tried not to swing around in his seat or curse at the screen. He raised his head very slowly, caught Leia's eye, and focused on the screen as if bored. No, he wasn't bored at all. He was furious and a little scared. He wondered how good an actor he was, but nobody seemed to be looking at him. It was probably because the image on the screen was of a younger Han, a man still with brown hair and relatively few lines. The picture of Leia was way out of date, too.
I think we better be going, said Leia. Some urgent laundry.
Upper City, Taras.
My name's Myrta Gave, said the girl.
Fett stared at the Heart of Fire necklace in the palm of his glove and wanted to clutch it in his bare hand, but he didn't know why. For the first time in many, many years, he felt grief. None of that turmoil showed. He made sure of that and studied her. Strongly built, heavy boots, practical armor, no jewelry, a battered, shapeless bag over one shoulder, and no concessions to feminine fashion whatsoever. Passers-by gave them a wide berth on the promenade.
So are you a bounty hunter, or do you just like armor?
Myrta, if that was her real name, nodded twice. She seemed utterly unafraid of him, and that was rare.
Yeah, I'm a bounty hunter, she said. Object recovery more often than prisoners. But I've survived so far. Aren't you going to ask me who killed Sintus Vell?
No.
Why?
Because we parted a long time ago.
Myrta shrugged and held out her hand for the necklace.
I know. You left your wife when your daughter was nearly 2. Sintus left on a bounty hunt before Aelin's 16th birthday and never came back. That's not common knowledge.
Okay, that's proof you know Aelin Vel.
And I need to return that necklace. It's all she has left of her mother.
Fett hesitated and handed back the Heart of Fire. He wanted it very badly, but he didn't rob kids like her of their meager bounties.
So, it's all Aelin has left. Like all I had of my dad was this armor and his ship. How is she?
What?
How's my daughter?
She's okay, I suppose. Angry, but she's surviving.
I think you know she tried to kill me.
She did mention it.
Does she know I'm alive?
Of course she does.
Aelin had chased him across the galaxy, or so she thought, and killed a clone she thought was him. If she knew he was alive now and hadn't tried again, then maybe she had changed her mind. No, that was stupid.
You left Sintus and your baby, and you never looked back. Is that how Dad treated you? No, he was always there for you. So what kind of a man abandons his own kid?
Do you think I want to see her again? I wouldn't even recognize her. She was a baby when I last saw her.
Why are you still talking to me then?
The girl was sharp. Not cocky, not insolent. Just sharp.
I wouldn't recognize my own kid. I see my own dad every day in the mirror, and never my own kid. What a thought to die with.
Why do you care if I find her?
Because you might pay me.
Right answer.
I'm just trying to get by in a tough galaxy.
How much?
She paused. It was the first time he'd seen her confidence waver. She doesn't know how much to ask.
5,000.
It was the cost of a repeating blaster.
Done. Payable when I see Aelin Vel and proof of who she is.
He didn't need her as a guide at all. All he had to do was find Han Solo, and he'd find Aelin hunting him. But that necklace had seized his interest.
You got transport?
Well...
Just so you don't skip out on the deal, you come with me.
Fett said.
I can keep a good eye on you in Slave One, girl. I'm heading Aelin's way anyway, so you're just ballast.
Take it or leave it,
Fett said.
Okay.
Let's go.